And along with that architectural and visual change, there is the first really significant efforts in converting the still largely Greek-speaking and Armenian populations of Asia Minor over to Islam. These efforts were particularly promoted by a man still remembered as the Mevlana, the inspired one, who is buried at Konya in the mosque. His real name is Jalal ud-Din Rumi'i. He was born in Persia, in Central Asia, in 1207, and was part of that refugee group escaping the Mongols and relocating to Asia Minor. He was an inspired thinker who reorganized one of the Sufi orders, one of the mystical orders of Sunni Islam. They're now known as popularly as the Whirling Dervishers, who used a combination of dance, inspirational teaching, to go out into the villages and towns of Asia Minor and to win over Christians to the Islamic faith. And they are extremely successful. The 13th and 14th century, in the course of about 125 or 150 years, the population becomes increasingly Muslim and eventually Turkish in speech. And this is one of the great religious and ethnic transformations of the late Middle Ages. And again, it goes back to the sponsorship of these sultans of Konya, who find themselves in a position that they can now promote Islamic letters and religious life. They now have the institutions to develop trade, to tax their subjects, which was not the case in the 12th century. And one of the main reasons they can do this is that they no longer face a Byzantine competitor. That Byzantium has been removed from the cultural and political chessboard of Asia Minor as a significant player. One wonders what would have happened if Theodore the First and his successors in Nicaea had attempted to contest that they had looked east rather than northwest to Constantinople. But that was not the case. So that even though in 1243, a Mongol army enters Asia Minor, and at the Battle of Kursa Dah, which really means sort of bearded or shaggy mountain, it's on the traditional North Anatolian invasion route, that the Mongols handily crush the army of the Seljuk Sultan and impose a Mongol protectorate over Asia Minor. And this sees the eventual fragmenting of the Sultanate of Konya. And it does. It goes into a period of the so-called Beybilrik, that is the various emirs, the beys, the independent rulers. But the institutions are in place. The institutions are there. The trade networks are there. The money, the religious conversion and transformation of the peninsula, all of those key institutions have already been forged. And while the Seljuk sultans of Konya may not be the ones who take them to their logical conclusion, they are very quickly replaced by border lords, the so-called Ottoman emirs, who do. And they will take those institutions, along with certain centralized institutions from Byzantium, to create that second great axis of power, a new axis of power, one that did not exist at the opening of this course, and that is a Muslim state entrenched in Asia Minor and ultimately coming to rest at Constantinople, Istanbul. And it is Constantinople and Cairo together, those two great political orders that will come out of the Middle Ages for the Islamic world, that will give you the Ottoman Empire, the unification of the Islamic world, which will endure for five centuries thereafter and will be the basis of the most of the heartland of the Islamic world down to, well, to the early 20th century, when that empire is finally dismembered and broken up into the existing states of the Middle East today. And that the Crusades did feed in very much to this change in the axis of power, that it did give advantages both to Cairo and to the Turks of Asia Minor to construct these orders, to go ahead with the cultural changes, the economic changes that followed it. And so it isn't fair to just dismiss the Crusades as tangential to Islamic history. Far from it. Both the Sultan in Konya as well as the Sultan in Cairo breathe very easily that the Fourth Crusade didn't show up, that they didn't have to face a Byzantine fleet, and that the Crusaders were nowhere to be seen. And it's with that thought, with the emergence of these new Islamic powers who have profited from the Crusades in many ways, I want to close this lecture and bring us back to the Crusaders themselves, the Franks of the coast, who are still holding those ports against the Ayyubid sultans. What did they experience as a result of the Fourth Crusade and this effort still to try to retake Jerusalem? And that's the next point in the story.